Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. Today's special guest is Rob Williams. You know him as the writer behind Sword of Hyperborea, which is part of the Hellboy universe that he's writing with Mike Mignola. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Hello, Mr. Williams. Thank you for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, thank you for having me from your cosmic seat up in the stars there. It's I'm glad you can hear me way up in the sky.
Yeah, this is my whole traversing the stars kind of motif I'm going for, you know.
I get it.
And you're one of the stars that I bump into along the way of my journey.
a low-tier star, but a star is a star.
You most certainly are a star, though. So the question I usually start with is, what inspired you to become a writer, and who were your earliest influences?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, it was just like, it was always something I enjoyed and something I was good at in one form or another. And I remember sort of being in infant school, so maybe, about 7 years old, and the head teacher talking to my parents and saying, look, he'll be a writer at some point. But you don't know. I mean, I grew up in a place called the Rhondda Valley, which is in the South Wales Valleys industrial area. It's not an easy path to sort of to see ahead of you. You know what I mean? There's not a great sort of loads of writers in my family or anything. You don't know how to do it, how to go about doing it for a living. So I trained as a journalist, and I figured that's kind of what I did. I was always a huge comic reader as a kid and loved it. But I didn't think you could do it for a living, because when you read comics, they were written by people like Stan Lee, and they were drawn by people like Jack Kirby, and all these people lived in Manhattan or New York City or something, which is, you know, I was on the other side of the world. So it never really felt like an option or something to chase. So I was working as a professional journalist for several years, and I wrote one comic script and it got published. And that, as ever with things, you know, that led to more jobs and more open doors for me. And suddenly I wrote a few more comics, and before I knew it, I was kind of like pretty much a full-time comic writer. I fast-forwarded through a number of years. It didn't just happen instantly. Mm-hmm. But it was never, it was a kind of lucky, in a way, it's me following my passion, but it's not as if I was this driven, I will be a comic writer, because I just didn't ever think it was possible. In terms of who inspired me, I don't know. I mean, I guess Alan Moore, growing up, reading 2000 AD and reading Captain Britain and Marvel Man and Warrior, you know, that always seemed like that was right, you know, of a different level. You could tell even when I was however old I was, 12, 13, you know. And I guess Frank Miller's Daredevil, I think, had a big effect on me back in the day. In terms of sort of prose, you know, there's sort of obscure people like, I don't know, like Daniel Woodrell, whose novels I really enjoy, and his writing I think is wonderful. And people like Don DeLillo. And a lot of TV writers, I would say, inspire me. People like David Chase. And, you know, that to me has been some of the finest writing I've seen in the last couple of decades. So you get inspiration from all kinds of places.
So as a journalist, how did that develop your writing in a way that assists you as a comic writer?
I went to a place called the Cardiff School of Journalism, which is like quite well respected in the UK. And it was quite brutal from day one, where we had a lecturer who was a bit like a sort of a Welsh Yoda, who would scream at us and kind of go, how do you know? No one cares about your opinion. And sort of, you know, it was a bit like you've seen Whiplash with J.K. Simmons with drumming. It was, yeah. It was not quite that brutal, but it was heading in that direction. And I think what that did is it taught you brevity, and it taught you sort of discipline, and it taught you, just sort of, it taught you a lot of things, basically, and but you come in quite, I think it knocked the ego out of you, because everyone who's any good at writing to any kind of degree comes in and goes, I'm gonna write all this my flowery prose, and I'm gonna and be very poetic, and in journalism terms you would just get effectively whacked with a ruler and go, no one cares about that. It's got to be no one cares who you are or what you think, and take I out of them. Never write I in a journalistic piece, because, you know, so all that stuff was good. And then I went off and I worked for a video production company, and I wrote, I wrote for visuals. I mean, it was very boring videos. I wrote corporate videos on things like sewage treatment plants and something. It was not romantic at all. But what it did do is teach me to write visually. And that's kind of nudged me towards trying to write my first comic script. I thought, well, I'm writing visual scripts. So comics is a visual medium. So, you know, I'll give it a go. And I think screenplay writing, there's a lot of things like I went to Robert McKee's lecture series in London over about 3-4 days. I've read a load of books on, you know, all kinds of, you know, screenplay writing structure, and all these books are filled with stuff you will go, I don't agree with that, that's rubbish. But you will find really good practice in all of them, you know what I mean? But you just pick and choose, you know. And even there's screenplay writing books like Save a Cat by Blake Snyder, which is quite derided for creating formulaic writing, which is true, but it also, there's a lot of good tips in there as well. So you know, I don't think you go in as a zealot with this stuff. You listen, you learn, you take on board what's good for you, and you put that into your work. But I think if anyone who wants to write for a living, I think, you know, you've learned structure, learned sort of formalism. And if you want to break it later on, you know, it's like Miles Davis had to learn the basics of playing his instrument before he decided to sort of get postmodern and create amazing jazz. So I think, you know, you need to kind of take your ego out of it and sort of be willing to learn.
You know, I agree with that 100%. With my students, when I teach them how to write, specifically essays, I always start off with, you know, the formula, like the template, you know, this is how you write a paragraph, this is how you insert your quote, everything else. Give them that foundation. But after that, hopefully they get good enough at some point in their life to break away and go, this is now how I can write with my voice. But I do think that foundation is absolutely necessary. If you don't understand the foundation, then and that organization, everything else, then I think you don't know how to even approach how to break it.
Yeah. And I think it's that's doing it for a living, right? Because I think when you start out, you get told these myths that, and maybe some people are like this, right? I'm not a superhuman. Some people who just don't just like download stories fully formed into their heads and go, oh, the muse is upon me, now I will write.
Yeah.
You need structure to get you where you need to go. And then you build off that. You do your interesting, esoteric, your voice things. But it's like, it's a very well-trodden metaphor, but it's like the structure is the spine and within the body. And then you can have one body can be super fat and horrible, and one body can be beautiful and well-toned and well-defined. Right. But you've got to have a structure there, otherwise it all starts falling apart. And you know, three-act structure, I can be a lot more complicated with certain stories, but I find three-act structure, it really just sets you on the right path. Then you, like you say, you can, then you do interesting things with it. And I think, but you, as long as it's like anything, you've got to know the basics first.
I agree with you 100%. So you recently have gotten involved with the Hellboy universe, otherwise known as the Magnoliaverse.
Yeah.
Were you a fan of the Hellboy characters prior to coming on board to write sort of Hyperborea?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've been reading Hellboy and BPRD and those books for a long time. Really big admirer of what Mike Mignola's done. You know, he's one of the, you know, just amazing artist and writer, I think. You know, doesn't get enough credit for his, you know, the quality of his writing. And then BPRD, I think, was a wonderful book which ran, if people don't know, because everyone knows Hellboy, everyone's heard of Hellboy, but BPRD was this book which ran by the side of it, which are kind of tonally slightly different, a bit more sort of militarized, you know, monster hunters effectively, I guess, would be the high concept. And then you had Mike working with John Arcudi through the bulk of that, was a fantastic writer. And some of the best artists, you know, just like people like Guy Davis and James Harron and Lawrence Campbell, who I'm working with on the sort of Hyperborea. And they ran sort of in tandem with each other. Hellboy would appear in BPRD occasionally, but, you know, the main storyline is Hellboy's. And they would flip back and forth, and just some of the, for me, genuinely, some of the most enjoyable comics of the last sort of 20 years or whatever.
Mm.
So to get a chance to collaborate with Mike and with Lawrence Campbell is a real treat for me, actually. And work I admire, and also it I think it pushes you to try and do your best work, because frankly you're slightly terrified of the quality of the quality that's gone before you. You know, you don't want to turn up and suddenly sort of lower the tones.
Well, like I said, I mean, obviously Mike Mignola is one of those legends of the comic book industry. And Hellboy kind of has become an iconic character in the world of comics. I mean, he's been around now for about 30 years. There's an entire generation that always has known Hellboy now. Mm. What do you think the key has been to the success of that, to that universe? And when you're approaching as a writer for that universe, what do you think you can add to it and make, you know, your mark in that sandbox, especially when it's somebody else's sandbox they started with?
In terms of why it stands out, I think first and foremost, this is not the only reason it stands out, is just it's some of the most beautiful comic art that you've ever seen. And that's Mike. And that's also Mike's collaborators. And, you know, when he does just write and work with people like Duncan Fegredo, who's an astonishing artist. And then people like Guy Davis and James Harron, it's just been the best looking comics. And then you've got Dave Stewart's colors, who are, again, have just become just absolutely beautiful and make that stuff just pop and shine. And it's pop. You know, Mike does this thing where it's kind of, you can see Jack Kirby in there, I guess. And, you know, it's got that exaggerated, enhanced sort of comic stuff. I mean, when Hellboy punches someone, he says bang or pow or you know, whatever. And it's visceral, and it feels like you could hang it in a gallery, and it's kind of OTT. But if you read the stories, they're rooted in folklore from around the world. Hellboy is a fantastic creation because he's the garage mechanic. He's the everyman who just wants really sort of to be a quiet life and smoke a cigar, and sort of he's Ben Grimm in Fantastic Four in his tone, I guess. But he is kind of like the chosen one in a tragic tale of the end of a world where it's monsters and demons and all this stuff, which makes for great comics on the page. But I think, you know, I reread recently the Wild Hunt, the Hellboy story that Mike did with Duncan Fegredo, and he's a tragic character. He's like that stuff is this heartbreaking stuff in that, because he just wants to be a quiet, good guy, and every demon and witch and whatever he encounters keeps telling him, you are fated to end the world. And I don't want to end the world. Just leave me alone, and no one will end it. Leave it alone. So I think it's not only is it sort of aesthetically an absolute jamboree of a book, it does what good storytelling does. It makes you care about the characters, and it sort of pulls you in, and you're along. You're totally along for the ride, you know. So I think it achieves both those things. It's got spectacle and it's got heart.
Now, as someone, you know, a lot of people with Hellboy, they know that Hellboy in Hell, in many ways, kind of ended felt like it ended the Hellboy story, at least in the in the progression. Are there stories that are taking place after the Hellboy in Hell comic books, either with Hellboy or without, that kind of that you're going to be working on and exploring?
Well, Sword of Hyperborea, I should explain, is, well, giving away spoilers, it's kind of there has been a sword in the story, which is like an Excalibur-like artifact, whereby basically it's got great power, and people who are long-time readers will recognize it. It was played a big part in BPRD. So what we talked about when we were trying to put this book together with Mike and with Lawrence Campbell, who was heavily involved in the plotting as well, was this big gaps, like 100-year, 1,000-year gaps. Like, how did this sword end up in a sort of rundown occult temple in Chicago, in a building in Chicago. It's like, well, how the hell did it get there? We saw it in London, in Edward Gray's offices in the end of the 19th century. So even that is like 100-year plus sort of journey. And so how does it end up in America? And so we thought, well, it'd be fun to tell the story of the various people who've held the sword and carried it and passed it on, and their tale. Well, we start in issue one with Gal Dennar, who is this barbarian character in the hyper, you know, the end of a Hyperborean age, who is thousands and thousands of years ago. So this is a big epic spanning tale in four issues. And then we flipped between, we go to World War One in issue two with a brand new character called Grafling de Gotha, who's a kind of German spy. Then we go to World War II, start World War II, and we have a, you know, egocentric deep sea diver called Victor Olsen. And then in then we go to the Chicago blues scene, the electric blues scene of kind of Muddy Waters and those type of guys, where a southern bluesman has come up to Chicago to sort of try and make his fortune. And we're introducing a bunch of brand new characters who, you know, we're really excited about. And, you know, they could have their own stories and go their own way. We'll, you know, we'll see what the future holds for them. But without giving too much away, there is also something in this which, if you read the end of BPRD, you know kind of that was the end of Hellboy's story. There is something in this which kind of shows something beyond that, but I can't say too much about that.
So as the writer of the series, you're listed as the co-writer with Mike Mignola. How does that partnership work? And when, obviously, Mike Mignola is the creator of this entire universe, which is why it's named after Mignolaverse. When you have something in an idea that or a disagreement with Mike Mignola, is it, you know, intimidating to be like, no, Mike, what you have an idea of your universe is wrong. Let me do it my way. I mean, how does that partnership even work?
Yeah, there is that. I mean, it would be possibly foolish to say to Mike, Mike, I don't know what you're doing at this point. I think that would be folly. It's basically right. So how it worked was Lawrence Campbell was a good friend of mine, and we've done a bunch of books together. He was talking to Mike and the Dark Horse guys about doing a story potentially with Gal Dennar, this barbarian character. So Lawrence and the Dark Horse guys asked if I'd be interested in coming on as writer. And then Mike Mignola. So Mike had a plot for a Gal Dennar story that he had in mind. I think Mike, if I remember right, Mike said something like, you don't have to use this, but if you want to, go for it. And lo and behold, Mike turns out knows what he's doing storytelling wise. And we went, oh, that's kind of cool. And that's kind of a cool scene that Mike suggested. Mm. So he gave us the spine for the issue. And then it was just up to Lawrence and I to kind of, you know, put flesh on the bones and bring our own ideas to it and take it in a couple of different directions. After that point, it was really sort of Mike was there as a sounding board, and we would kind of have a couple of Zoom calls. And the cool thing is, like, Mike, a lot of the lore of the Hellboy universe, I get the impression there's a lot there that Mike hasn't written down, and it's in his head. So Mike would kind of go, oh, well, you know, that's actually this. And we would go, is it? Oh, okay. And that happened because of this. But in those conversations, Mike would also go, oh, I had this idea for this story, but I never did it, and blah, blah, blah. And it kind of, we're sitting there, Lawrence and I, kind of going, you could do 14 other stories coming out what Mike just said there. So, and then Mike will kind of go, no, but I'm retired. And then he goes, but he kind of can't help himself, but still, you know, come up with his stuff. It was fun because it was very collaborative and everyone was very welcoming to me as the newcomer. I mean, Lawrence and I have worked together a bunch of times before and we know each other really well. And we would knock ideas back and forth. And it's very collaborative. It's not an auteur type of book where I wrote the script and I gave, and do not touch my script, and gave it to Lawrence and Lawrence drew it. It you know, Lawrence would send all the breakdowns to me and say, what do you think? And we would sort of talk about different ways to do scenes. So we really approached it in a very, almost like it was a create your own project, the same way you would a create your own project. Because if you work for Marvel or DC very often, it's not like that. You write the script and you give the script to the editor and the editor hands it over to the artist. You might never know even who the artist is, let alone, you know. It wasn't that. This was kind of very much... very team built, put it that way, in every essence.
Yeah, it was a sort of Hyperborea. Obviously, it's a story of the sword and the kind of how it travels. Is the story really about the sword, or is the sword a catalyst for kind of filling out the history of the Mignolaverse that maybe readers have not explored yet?
I think it's a catalyst for, hopefully, doing like any good story, I mean, giving you characters and making you care about those characters and their emotional journey. Because, I mean, I don't think any of us would have been interested in a exposition-filled story which just fills in the gaps of in the Hellboy universe. You know, it's, you know, exposition is kind of like death on the page, frankly. I don't know a single writer enjoys writing it. So we didn't want this to be like, well, what you do not know is that the sword was here for many years and big tracts of text. We're not doing that. We in each of the four issues, we're giving you a protagonist and we're putting them on a journey and you know, putting their heart and souls on the line. And then sort of, you know, it's kind of, because we, you know, the main Hellboy universe story has been told, so I do get the argument. People go, well, why should people care about these books? But it's like any story, if you do it well, fingers crossed we've done it well, you know, you will get emotionally involved with these people, and especially with issues 2, 3, and 4, where brand new characters were invented, and it's the start of their journey. In a way, they're like those issues are like the origin tales for brand new players in the Hellboy universe, and whether or not they have more life will be decided upon, you know, whether people get excited by them, really.
I mean, one of the characters, or at least the main character so far, is Gul Dinar, who's a fascinating character. And I think it's the fascinating thing I think about him is, once again, he has such an interesting perspective of time because he's been around for such a long time. And for an individual as long-lived as he is, what does it mean to know how things are going to end? And does that make things, well, especially his long life, more or less precious for a guy who has lived that long? Is time more precious because he's always been alive and he's, you know, comfortable? Or is it less precious because he's been around for so long that maybe, you know, it's tired, you know, it's time to wrap it up?
I mean, I think thematically that was what was interesting to us and to me, especially in issue one, was Gul Dinar is kind of like, he has seen the future because he kind of has a very strangely, nebulously defined relationship with a character in our time called Howard, a BPRD agent, who kind of, they both, when Howard's picked up the sword, he kind of got Gul Dinar's memories and sort of occasionally kind of becomes Gul Dinar in the future. So Gul Dinar has seen how the world ends and he knows this battle, you know, spoilers, if people haven't read the end of BPRD, but all this battle, this fight is, the good guys lose, right? The humans lose, spoilers for the end of it. So when we join him in sort of Hyperborea, it's kind of like, what's all this about? Why should I carry on? Which is kind of like a little meta kind of note to sort of, why are we carrying on doing books in this universe, I guess. and he says, I cannot live in a world without hope. But then he thinks about some great warrior spirit put power into this sword, and his grandfather found the sword in a faraway land. So he goes on a great quest to try, if he can find these great mythic warriors of the past with this amazing power, maybe he can change the future. So it's kind of, it's a quest to find hope in a world that feels utterly hopeless. I like to say, without wanting to get too heavy with it, I mean, in a way, his journey is no different from any of ours. We all know our demise is out there somewhere waiting for us down the road. But, you know, we carry on. We find things to fight for, and we, along the way, we find love and we find joy and we find happiness and we find all the things that make up a life. So in a way, he's kind of no different from us. It's just his world has more, you know, flying dinosaurs, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure this is if you can answer the question, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. And you're welcome to say, I can't answer your question, please stop talking about it. But I'm going to ask it anyway. Obviously, when you have Dinar, once again, he knows the future, right? And he's trying to change it. Now, the stories that we understand now with BPRD and Hellboy and Hell and all that stuff, is that the vision that he sees and he's going to try changing it? Or is that the outcome of him already trying to have changed it?
Ooh, hang on. Let me try and wrap my head around that one, which is why this stuff gets... I don't know if it's... One of the great things about the Hellboy universe and BPRD universe is there are genuine stakes. You can have them, and they have had some of the most amazing characters, and they die and they're gone, and that, and it's heartbreaking. It's not Marvel and DC where if Hellboy, if Wolverine dies, you know, we know he's back in a year, or, you know, and if Batman dies, we know he's back in a year. I would imagine, I can't speak for Mike, but I imagine that given the tone of what everything has gone before, the idea of creating an offshoot where you could change the future or something, I don't think that's how the Hellboy universe works or ever has worked. Doesn't mean the characters can't try, but I think also, pretty inherent in these tales, in the Hellboy and the BPRD story, is tragedy, you know what I mean? And sort of a, you know, noble tragedy is a real heart render, which is probably why, part of the reason why so many people are so fond of this, of these stories. I think they're full of really good people who are fighting an insurmountable odds, basically.
So, as you mentioned, the sword was wielded by Denar's grandfather at some point, which means it has a life before that even. Mm. How much of the exploration of the story is going to be not just Denar, but the before?
Kiff, I'm trying to think what I can say here. I can't say anything to answer that question, really. It is much of a sort of, Mike kind of told us effectively what the sword is and how it works. I'm not saying it in this interview, put it that way.
Fair enough.
One of the great dictums that was given to us was, Mike said, trust me, there's one rule for this world, you don't want to explain too much. And I think that's one of the things people love about it, because I mean, it's like, I'm a big fan of Kubrick. Kubrick didn't have characters go, well, here's what the Stargate is, and here's what just happened, you know, and part of that, we make our own, you know, we fill in the blanks ourselves, and people get very invested, I think, as a result, much more so than a horrible expositionary tract, as I think I said earlier, but I don't think anyone involved is particularly fans of that type of stuff.
Oh, fair enough. And like I said, anytime I say anything that you can't answer, feel more free to say I can't answer. and I think you can answer, maybe I'll answer this. I had the great opportunity, obviously, to read the first issue, which was fantastic, by the way. I really enjoyed it. There's, I guess, I think the best, it's like a wolf spirit kind of thing that shows up, and basically says a line that I kind of want to explore with you just a little bit, if you can. Sure. He says, Denar is not the sword. So is that advice or is that a warning?
It's wisdom.
Okay.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily either of those things. I think at that point, I'm really wary of saying too much here because I just don't want to spoil the. Part of the thing I love about that scene is when apart from the fact it's drawn beautifully by Lawrence Campbell, is when the wolf spirit arrives and says this, and Gal Denar has drunk what we seem to be some kind of hallucinogenic, effectively, and he gets, you know, the wolf spirit is telling him some advice here, but the wolf spirit will pop up again as our series continues. But I think I don't think it's any spoilers to say the nature of a book and the themes that we're exploring, and the fact that there's four different individuals, again, equal amount of space in this series, is kind of going, and in first issue, the wolf spirit says Chicago, which I loved, because just to have that word said thousands of years in the past is just poof, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then the wolf spirit says to Gal, says Chicago, and what, I forget what Gal says, but he says something like, I understand, or I see. And he goes, right, I get that. And I think a bit of wisdom is kind of downloaded into his head there. And it's effectively, without giving too much away, the sword needs to be passed on. And that's why it is passed on to the character we'll meet in issue two, and will be passed on to the, you know, so this is, there is a thing of, this has to happen. But I think one of the things that, in a way, we're kind of building the structure of a story that's already gone. But in another way, as you'll see, we are, the amount of lives that are affected by just the journey of these characters, of the stories we're telling, And I think as well, one thing I would raise as well is that even though it seems hopeless to have, and this is all in issue one, this isn't a spoiler for what's to come. You see Howard's character holding a bridge in BPRD. We saw this already against the great monster. And he holds back the great monster and the last humans escape to the underworld, right? So one of the great tragedies about Galdena in the past is he doesn't know how that ends. For all he knows, the humans died as well. He didn't stay alive long enough to see that. So he thinks, oh, it was all for nothing. Mm. But what he doesn't realize, but what we know if we're BPRD readers, is him holding that bridge allows humanity to survive the end of the world, a small amount of humanity. But so the fact that the sword has to go full circle and end up in Chicago so Howards can pick it up actually allows everything that these four characters are doing in this miniseries are all pivotal to allow the human race to survive the end of BPRD.
Yeah, I really like that. And another part of the story that I just loved is when Dennar says, he states that he cannot live in a world without hope.
Yeah.
And the thought that popped in my head is the hope then Dennar, or is the hope then the sword?
I think it's... where to go with this? I don't think it's necessarily either of those things. It's just... you can have two ways of looking at it. In a way, the sword is, you know, a very powerful weapon, an artifact, right? We've seen that, right? So the sword is it's vital, but it's there. It gets to that point on that bridge, perhaps, to so allow the Howards to keep the monster at bay. But the sword is nothing if Howards doesn't make the choices he makes, which is to just leap into it and hack away at it and sort of, you know, that's Howards, that's Galdenar, that's his human bravery. It's not, and I think, you know, it's you know, any great story is about the choices people make. It's not about this sort of ex machina of a sword that can just, you know, that wipes out all the bad guys and suddenly we're, you know, the story has no stakes, has no gravitas. I think, you know, but it's all a human journey for all of us, isn't it, to try and find hope in sort of whatever we're all dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
And like I said, it's such a, and I really do like the concept of a story like that about hope within a universe that, as the reader, you kind of already know there isn't, because things, you know, how things play out. But I guess it also, once again, as you mentioned, how the meta aspect of the story, that there's hope then for the reader that maybe there is more story here during and after BPRD and obviously Hellboy in Hell that we can enjoy and keep reading for. And I kind of enjoyed that it seems to be a play on that as well.
Well, I think that, I mean, look, we're beset by prequels because, you know, the IP must sustain in various forms. And we're all quite right to be, well, have this feeling of, well, we know how the main story ends, so why should we care? But then I think the bottom line is, with all this stuff, is like, if it's really good and really well done, then I think Better Call Saul is an amazing example of that, where, you know, really a Breaking Bad prequel. Better Call Saul might well be better than Breaking Bad. It's just an amazing piece of work, and with characters you genuinely care about and you're concerned about and you worry about. And so at the end of the day, a good story is a good story, I think, is the bottom line. And I think, you know, I'm not saying, you know, we've sort of Hyperborea, but we're kind of creating something that will sustain in the same way that Hellboy is sustained. I'd be foolish to say anything like that. But all I will say is the fact that we all cared a lot when we were making it, and we wanted to try and make something that wasn't just a tie-in that you can just put out and people will pay $3.99 for. And you know, I mean, we're all sort of really genuinely trying to bring our A game to it.
So, for sort of Hyperborea, is it only for the fans who are familiar with the Hellboy verse, or can someone who's not familiar pick up this book and kind of catch up with what's happening?
I hope so. I mean, I don't know, that it's maybe not for me to say, but that's the intention. I think what issue one, you will see, you know, people know Galdenar. We've seen a few Galdenar stories before in the pages of BPRD, and we've seen Howards in BPRD. Issue two, I hope we're not too dependent on past history, but I mean, it's difficult to say. We've tried not to be. Issues 2, 3, and 4, brand new characters on brand new journeys. That's the first time you're ever going to meet them. So certainly, I think you could read those, and you're not going to be weighed down by what's gone before. Issue 1, I'm not probably in the best place to judge that, but we have genuinely tried to make this a comic that you could enjoy if you're not sort of super knowledgeable about Hellboy and BPRD, because it's quite a sparse comic as well. I mean, it's just one of the great things about sort of, you know, Mike's work in the past is like, you know, it's a visual medium, let the visuals tell the story. And I think as a writer, if you're working with someone who's really good, and I'm working with Lawrence Campbell, you are wise to get out of his way, basically. You know, one of the great bits of wisdom you learn as you go on as a comic writer, especially, is like if the visuals can tell the story and they're really good, don't put a shit ton of dialogue over the top of it and stop people seeing it. You know what I mean? It's like sometimes good writing is less as well, you know.
So what can our listeners look forward to in the future issues of Sword of Hyperborea?
Issue 2, like I said, is set against the back. Well, you will see, if you're a Hellboy fan, there's a brief period, you'll see a Sir Edward Grey, the Witchfinder. And then we go to Belgium, and we go to World War One, and there's a German spy called Grafling de Gotha. And she is called in by German intelligence because there's rumors of a house out in the woods where, you know, dark and terrible supernatural experiments are going on, and she has to investigate. I'm not saying any more than that. But that is sort of, again, you know, set against. I was kind of interested. I always wanted to do a story with Zeppelins and the fact that, like, the first air attacks on London, and I always had in mind to do a scene which blows my mind, where people looked up in the sky and saw these huge flying things for the first time. No one knew, at that point, even knew what, you know, I was like, oh, what the hell are they like? And and then human beings being human beings, bombs were dropped from them. So that's all kind of tied in there, as you'll see. And then issue 3 is we leap forward to World War II and the start of World War II of the English Channel. And there's a character we really like called Victor Olsen, who is the world's greatest deep sea diver. And he's an alcoholic and a mad, egocentric, and just kind of Oliver Reed, basically, in a diving suit. And he's been hired by some mysterious people to dive down to a wreck to try and find something. And then, yeah, I can't say any more about that because there's too many spoilers. And then, as I said earlier, issue 4, I'm sort of really interested in, you know, Chicago. You know, Chicago is a big part of our story, and that's where the sword's going, and we know that. But I love the fact that, in a way, the electric blues scene in Chicago really kind of created rock and roll. Is where rock and roll came from. And rock and roll kind of created the cultural sort of milieu of what America is at the end of the 20th century. So in a way, it kind of comes from the Deep South and the blues men of the Deep South. And of course, the blues music came from, you know, the slave songs that they sang, you know, and then it eventually became the blues, and then it eventually goes to Chicago and it plugs in and it becomes rock and roll. So we're kind of following that mythic American heritage, cultural heritage, and ending up with a great character called One Leg Elijah Bone, who is this blues man who, without saying too much, has a voice speaks to him and it tells him things are going to happen in the future, and it terrifies him. He's not entirely sure what this voice is, but it tells him to go to certain places, and he gets into more than he bargained for, put it that way.
Oh, Mr. Williams, it sounds like a fantastic story. I look forward to reading. When's the next issue expected to come out?
Oh, I don't have the exact date, but I know that the first issue came out about a week and a half ago, so we will be somewhere in the middle of February.
Well, I look forward to reading it, sir. Thank you so much for being a fantastic guest. I greatly appreciate it.
And
no problem. I hope our readers pick up Sword of Hyperborea. Like I said, the first issue was really well done.
All right, thank you, man. Cheers.
Thank you. Have a fantastic day. Stay safe.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, mate. And good luck with the snow.
Oh, thank you so much.